Sustain 267.
To the Sustain 267 podcast, where we host conversations on different issues affecting climate change in Botswana and the rest of Africa. I am your host, Patokile Sitse. 2020 has been quite a year. On the 25th of July, Panamanian flagged freighter, the MV Wakashio, owned by Japanese company Nagashiki Shipping, en route to Brazil, carrying 3,800 tons of fuel oil and 200 tons of diesel oil, ran aground on a coral reef off the Indian island of Mauritius, resulting in an oil spill in the ocean. The MV Wakashio ran aground at a known sanctuary for rare wildlife. The area also contains wetlands designated as a site of international importance by the Ramsar Convention on Wetlands. The spill is also close to two environmentally protected marine ecosystems and the Blue Bay Marine Park Reserve. The area is special. It has a specific brain coral which can live up to 100 years, a thriving mangrove forest and endangered chameleons. The coral in that area had just been regenerated after 15 years of efforts by environmentalists. Although the Mauritian government has a national oil spill contingency plan, it is only adequate with a spill of less than 10 tons, which is significantly less than the 1,000 tons of oil that had escaped from the ship and into the ocean. The people of Mauritius took to the front line to clean up their beaches and have succeeded in cleaning up nearly 460 tons. It is worth noting that the ship was about 2 kilometers off the southeast coast of Mauritius when it went underground, even though it was supposed to be 16 to 32 kilometers away from the island. Today, we are joined by Senior Portfolio Manager at Greenpeace International, who has previously served as a member of the Mauritian Parliament, former member of the Pan-African Parliament, and Senior Advisor to the Prime Minister of Mauritius on environmental matters between 2010 and 2014, Mr. Mokshanand Sanil Dawakasing. First, I asked him to share with us what is happening in Mauritius as someone on the ground and how he's experiencing it.
Well, what has been going on, it's like, so you must know the whole story. It's like, you know, that the ship wrecked and stayed on the reefs for 12 days without government acting or authorities doing anything to act on the ship. And on the 6th of August, then we had the first leakage, and it's around 1,000 metric tons of fuel now, heavy oil, has already leaked in the ocean. Well, three days ago, the leakage stopped because we managed to empty the damaged tank. So there's no more leakage going on in the lagoon at the moment. So, and today I just learned this morning that we are about to complete the operation of emptying the other two tanks, which contain like 2,500 tons, metric tons of fuel. So that exercise also will be completed by today. So in a nutshell, I would say that if we succeed in that operation, hopefully, which we will do by this evening, so there won't be any further leakage by with the ship. So the danger now will be the ship. The ship is about to break into two. But eventually that won't have any major impact in terms of oil spilled because we have removed all the oil. So this is the actual situation when it comes to the overall picture. What I can also tell you that like yesterday, the feedback we got like 395 tons of this fuel has been screamed off from the sea. So we've been able to remove more or less like 400 tons of this fuel that was floating on the ocean. So which makes it like still like 600 tons of fuel to address. So whether they're on the shoreline or they are still floating on the sea. So this we need to know. So basically the operation is going well, but the whole shoreline, more than 15 kilometers, has been really touched. And some of these places severely touched. When I say severely touched, it's like heavy, like 6-7 inches of heavy deposit of oil, which is smelling very bad and also which is very sticky. And it's toxic, by the way. So the mangroves have been severely impacted. A lot of the shoreline has been severely impacted. But the good thing is like, we don't have sandy beaches in this region. This is the only region of the island where there is no sandy beach. I would say that is God blessed. At least if an incident of this nature had to happen, it happened there. It's not very good to say that, but it should not happen anywhere. But then, you know, it happened there, and we didn't have. But we have a serious. It has touched seriously the mangroves, this would be a major issue. Dealing with cleaning up and restoring those mangroves will be one of the biggest challenge at this stage.
And then you said we have emptied the tanks. When you say we, who are you speaking about?
Now, when we are speaking, I'm talking about the country in general, but the tanks have been emptied by the local authorities in Mauritius with the support of technical expertise by the French people. And yes, so there's a technical team around. And there's a salvage team, which they have put in place. And the salvage team now has emptied. It's their work to do that. When I say I was just referring to the country as a whole, being a patriot.
Okay. And then the Mauritius Prime Minister declared a state of environmental emergency on Friday, the 7th of July, because the island was battling to contain the oil spill. Practically, what does declaring a state of environmental emergency mean?
So the idea behind this environmental emergency, so the Prime Minister used the provisions, Section 34 of the Environmental Protection Act, 2002, amended in 2008. So there's a provision there that you can, if the Prime Minister in consultation with the Minister of Environment, if you see that there's an oil spill, then that could become a national danger. So you can announce this emergency. What does this emergency do? It prevents people. You can't have access to all those sites become a restricted zone. And eventually, all those sites are actually restricted zone. But despite that, the civil society didn't listen to this emergency. They are on the ground, so they are not respecting this emergency at all. I didn't respect it. I was on the ground, so no one is really. Those who are really helping and cleaning are not really respecting this this emergency. But the other thing is, you had to register yourself to make yourself known if you want to be a volunteer. So that was also a process was established. So this is what it meant.
That was actually the next thing that I was going to read up on, because I saw that the Ministry of Environment had released a statement that they're trying to find the best way to orchestrate the cleanup, and they were warning the public to stay away. But then when you go on the internet, the people who are at the front are students, environmental activists, citizens of the country. And then it made me wonder, how does what they are saying reconcile with what is happening on the ground? Seeing as they're saying one thing, but another thing is happening on the ground. Are citizens and government on the same page? How's the relationship between the two in light of the oil spill?
I can tell you that the relation with the government and the civil society is not at its best. There's a sense of revolt among the civil society. That's why they are probably not respecting the emergency at all, because they know government has failed them once by not acting for more than 12 days on a ship that was wrecked, and the imminent danger was the oil spilled. And from day one, I did mention and raise up this issue in our local media, in our local press, that we have to remove the oil. All the oil has to be emptied from the ship. Whatever happens to the ship, I was less concerned about the ship. I was more concerned about the oil spill and protecting our lagoon. So from day one, and I have been quoted and I have been cited by many of the newspaper later, because I gave that piece of advice and nobody listened. So there's also a sense of revolt in the population that government is not doing that. And the government, so putting it a state of emergency has been has been challenged by the population. They've challenged that state of emergency and they're going on the sites. They are cleaning everything. I know today a group of 100 persons, my friends, they are starting a new venture to try to clean the mangroves. So they've started. So, yeah.
But then also, I get why the civil society is not listening, but why didn't the government act? They could have prevented this as compared to trying to now cure the mangroves. Why didn't they act, especially because they had been advised by an expert in the area?
That's a big question everybody is asking. Why the government didn't act for 12 days. And now I was just reading a piece of information. I don't know how true that it is. And it is in front of me here. The Prime Minister acted on the advice given by the experts from the salvage team. So they said that it was difficult for them to remove the oil from the tank. I'm just reading this piece of paper that's in front of me now. So that's very serious. I view that if that piece of information is true, but then that is very serious because, of course, the experts of the ship, they would try to save their ship. For them, whatever happened, the lagoon and the problem of the lagoon is not an issue. But you are the head of the government. Your duty is to save your lagoon, to save the livelihood of your people. That's what didn't happen. But I can't say at this stage, most probably, this is a good question to ask. I have my idea. I have my small hypothesis or what could have happened, what could have taken place. Like there are many other documents also, which now I'm getting hold on. They are very serious, but I'm not going to, I can't give it on international media for the time being. I have some very damning reports that came as well. But anyway, we'll talk about it. I will raise those issues in my roundtable discussion a bit later today.
Will it be in English, the roundtable?
No, that will be most probably in Creole, local language.
So, yeah. Oh, okay. I was hoping to listen in. And then going back to the actions by the civil society, how have people been helping? What are the solutions that they've come up with thus far? I read that the company that was responsible for the oil spill has sent over six personnel to help with the cleanup as well. Has that contributed so far? But I think mostly I'm curious about the solutions that volunteers have taken up to now.
I haven't seen much of these. I haven't seen much of these experts on the ground. I haven't seen them much. I don't know where they are. Probably they are working from an office, but not on the ground. I can confirm today if I go again. Yesterday I was on the ground nearly all day. I didn't see them. So this is one thing. Yeah, how the civil society did, I mean, that was like a survival instinct. The first thing was like there was a sense of revolt to start with. Oh, yeah, what's... And then immediately, you know, the love for the country, the love to save this lagoon overtook everything. That sense of revolt was overtaken by emotional thing to save the... By the emotional, you know, love for the places. And then they started devising their own booms and, you know, using the straw. And somebody came up with this idea, we need to make those booms because we don't have enough. And they started manufacturing lots of them. And this has been the most efficient tool so far to contain the oil from reaching the shore. I think if you see that we've been able yesterday to collect 395 metric tons of fuel still floating on the ocean, without these booms, this fuel would have already reached the shoreline. So do you evaluate the contribution of the civil society here? It's like 40% of the oil so far. And I'm sure there must be more, but already that has shown that for 395 tons collected, and this is what the civil society has contributed to contain by the genius idea of building those booms. And then the second thing they are doing is like labor-intensive cleaning, going on the sites, picking all this stuff, you know, without even being scared of their health. Now, just imagine, I couldn't stand like half an hour on spot there. I was cleaning also day before yesterday. Half an hour, you just have to move out and breathe some fresh air and then come back again. Now, just imagine people spending whole day in cleaning, so, and labor intensive, using gloves and everything, and they are on those spots. So, yes, this has been the contribution of the civil society. But also, I would like to say the private sector in Mauritius has also been very, very, very helpful. In fact, one of the leading banks of the island today is giving what I've first time I'm just hearing that. They call it a social leave. So they are releasing their employees now and to go and to clean. So that will be some sort of initiative. The private sector also has been very helpful in doing that. University students. Different components, you know, all the service club, the Lions Club, the Rotary Clubs, I mean, just name it, they have been on the ground.
As I'm listening to you, I'm just thinking to myself, I love it. There's this thing that has come up quite a couple of times on the podcast of we are the ones we've been waiting for. So the people of Mauritius had this challenge that they didn't even plan, that they could have fallen victim to, and they came up with their own solutions and they've had such amazing results.
They have surpassed the government into this restoration process.
But then also you speak about how dangerous the fumes from this oil is. Have there been any health incidents so far?
No. So far as I know, no health incidents so far. I think people are taking the basic precautions. They are wearing their masks. Everybody had to wear a mask. It's COVID-19 regulation here. So you have to wear your mask already. And now they are just using all these kit, overall kit. They are using their gloves and boots. So companies that manufacture boots locally have been donating a lot of boots to people. Don't go into the polluted areas like with naked hands and all. So there is a sort of limitation in terms of health hazard, and which is a good thing as well. But it might so happen, but that doesn't mean it's being linked. You might get one or two cases, but that doesn't mean it's necessarily linked with the pollution here. But if we don't remove it, then it will become a super dangerous health hazard.
Now then, while we're on the topic of health, moving over to COVID-19, the whole country, the whole world actually right now is reeling from COVID-19. They're trying to contain it. They're trying to address it. I know in Mauritius, you've done a pretty decent job of keeping your numbers low. I think, what do you think the impact of this will be on your COVID-19 response, considering that your economy as well, which is already so reliant on tourism, has taken quite a beating from people not traveling? So the combination of those two.
Yes. In fact, we fought COVID-19 very well. In fact, the country is COVID-free. Those active cases the country is COVID-free for quite a while. We were among the first, among those first countries that were COVID-free. But only those people that you see the active cases are those people that are traveling or expatriate or the Mauritian who are staying abroad, which we flew in. So some of these people are contaminated. Yes, but it was a massive blow on the economy and the tourist industry. We are still locked down. No flight is coming to Mauritius. And in fact, there were already serious discussion going on whether we should open up by September. And in the meantime, this crisis came in. So people were just like hoping. But I need to add that government stepped in as well into all this tourism sector and informal sector as well to support people financially. Yeah. Through a workfare scheme. So people were not earning what they used to earn when they worked, but they got stipend. Maybe it was not enough, but it was being supported by government. So let's give them the credit. At least they've done a good job. But now this ecological crisis will hit the tourism industry in this part. But I mean, globally also, our image will be hit because now people will talk, oh, oil spilled Mauritius. No one would like to go and travel to Mauritius. Though people won't know that the most beautiful spaces, I mean, all the beautiful spots have not been touched. Yeah, all the beautiful spots have not been touched here. It's only the eastern coast, southeast and eastern coast, which has been touched. So all these beautiful beaches of the northern, eastern, top northeast, southeast, and all western coast, they are still being unaffected by this oil spill. But how are you going to explain that to the world? That is another story. But then more precisely, people living in that particular region, a lot of them earn their living, you know, on this ocean, on this lagoon. They are fishermen, registered and unregistered. They are like pleasure craft people. There are a lot of people like take you for diving, you know, snorkeling, and going up to the small pineapple vendor who earns his living, you know, by sending pineapples to tourists. So all these people will be affected. There's the whole chain. They will be affected, doubly affected. This is where probably one of the things that we are fighting here, we need a compensation for these people. I don't know how long this lagoon will be impacted and will be how long this lagoon will take to regenerate, at least for the fish to come back, etc. But in the meantime, these people will have to be given a sort of a compensation for their livelihood.
It's good to hear that the most beautiful parts of Mauritius haven't been affected. I think definitely the country will need a big PR campaign to tell people that we're still beautiful. And then also speaking of compensation or just support for the communities that have been affected by this oil spill, the executive vice president of the company that's responsible for the oil spill at a news conference issued an apology. and said that they would do anything, they would do everything they can to ensure that this doesn't happen again. What are your thoughts on that issued apology?
The apology came after 19 days their ship were wrecked. They took so long to present an apology. And let me tell you, that apology didn't come like that. It came under pressure. It came under pressure. And I can tell you, it came a bit under pressure from a local organization based in Japan, including Greenpeace. So, but an apology will not cure the pain of the people. An apology will not restore our marine ecosystems. An apology will not help the country or all these polluted sites to gain their original status or to become like they used to be. So we need more than apologies now. I'm sorry, we need much more than apologies. This is what there is like an international movement going on right now to claim much more than simple apologies to the company. I can't tell you more than that, but in the days to come, you will probably witness, if you're in touch with Greenpeace, you will be in touch with an open letter going to this company.
As you speak about an apology not being enough, with some of the oil spills that we've seen previously, such as in Bono in Nigeria, we've seen Shell paying financial compensation to those communities. Do you see that kind of accountability being held with the company?
I think there will be, there will be a lot of pressure. Already there are 3 or 4 local court cases that has already been filed. So, and I'm sure there will be international court cases also that will be filed. But how long those court cases will take, I don't know. Sometimes they take very long to come to a judgment. But I'm sure there will be a lot of pressure for the company to act. Let's see how that goes. At this moment, I can't tell you more because there's nothing much going on there. But there's a long process. We need to assess the damages caused, environmental damages. We need to assess the social impact. We will need to address the financial impact, and then you put it all together, then you can make a claim to the insurer, to the company. But that is a long process that will take time.
And then in moving forward, the people of Mauritius have already done an amazing job of cleaning up the oil. What can we do to help? What can the rest of Africa do to help? What can the rest of the world do to help you during this time with the oil spill?
First of all, I mean, solidarity from the African continent will be the great thing. And adding pressure on this Japanese company would be another thing that probably that could help if civil society could join this international solidarity movement, you know, to put pressure on this company. I think that would be a great thing. So those are the things that I believe the country can do, because actually you can't travel to the country, etc. So there's nothing more physical that you could do but you could do more things like, you know, diplomatic things at a higher level, putting pressure, etc. So this would be the sort of thing that in the first stage would be very important. Support the international solidarity, put pressure on this Japanese company to do the needful in terms vis-a-vis the local communities, and to make sure that their proper assessment is being done and people are being compensated for all the losses they've encountered for this crisis. Yeah. So I think that would be great. Maybe in that sense, if the media, international media also could help, that would be great.
Okay. And when you speak of solidarity and adding pressure, are we talking about online, our tweeting, our letters? If someone were to listen to this podcast, what call to action would they be? What could they do practically after listening to help the situation? What would solidarity look like?
Yes, I mean, what I would say, like in terms of international movements going on, I know there's something that has been started and initiated by Greenpeace Africa. And that will go global. I think, first of all, if people can support that initiative by signing on whether on an open letter or whatever initiative that comes in, that will give more, that will add pressure and will give more punch to the demands that is in there. And secondly, probably, I don't know how this will build up, but in terms of local group pressurizing, you know, Japanese embassies around could be another thought, you know, or heading to Japanese embassies with some letter, you know, so that you keep adding the pressure and keep maintaining the pressure. Well, apart from that, I don't know, it's like using more of the social media today and making the issue more international and putting a lot of pressure on social media. Because these companies, I do think they do take care of social media as well. So that's the virtual way of putting pressure. So virtual pressure will be great.
Thank you for that. And then lastly, what should we learn and take away from this incident and turning it into a learning experience as people, as leaders, and as nations?
Right. Fossil fuel is not only a problem for us, global warming. Fossil fuel is not a problem that is going to affect the lives of everybody, especially the African continent. Fossil fuel is also dangerous when you carry them along. And this oil spill is a living example of how fossil fuel is dangerous. So we have to get rid of fossil fuel once for all. Not only like using them in the countries, but also if we don't use them, if the demand falls, there will be less such carriers with oil going around in the oceans, and the danger would be less. So the lesson is, let's end up with fossil fuel.
Thank you so much for those closing words. Hopefully people will hear them and they'll act on them.
On Africa Bites this week, still in Mauritius, we speak to Riyad Subrati. As usual, I first asked him to tell me a little about himself.
I'm a farmer, do a new type of farming, which is called, it's an agribusiness, which does growing of vegetables in greenhouses using the hydroponic technology. I have like 3,500 meter squared area that I covered, which I use to grow from tomatoes to broccoli, cabbage, just name it. So I have done that for the past 3 years when I decided to reconvert myself. Before, I've been working as a procurement director for several hotels project around the island. So this was what I was doing. In my philanthropic life, I have been, I'm still a member of the Junior Chamber International. I have been on this board of directors in 2016, and I'm also a lifetime member. So I use this platform to be able to engage young people into climate change.
What does climate change mean to you? So your understanding of what it is.
For me, climate change is a phenomenon that we have to take care of, that we have to really work with and understand that it is something that we are not going, that is being a problem of the society. And that we cannot say that we do not form part of this problem. Everyone forms part of it, despite that there are certain countries who are more polluters than the others. But the atmosphere is one atmosphere. We all bear the same consequences of climate change. So it is a phenomenon that we are all affected with, and we have to all put our minds in to make sure that we can reverse its changes.
And then how has climate change affected you as Riyad directly?
Okay, directly in my business, it has really affected me because I'm a farmer. And what I've noticed is that with the increasing carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere, from what we've learned, is that we are getting a rise in the temperature year after year. And the fact that I grow crops in, I use the hydroponic system to grow crops in greenhouses. Now I'm seeing that my installations, the greenhouse itself, are no more adapted for the high temperature that we are having. So we are having to make certain changes in terms of the structure to be able to adapt with the high temperatures that we are having every year. So I've noticed that where I am from in Mauritius, like 3 years ago, the highest temperature that would be reaching would be like 34 degrees. We are now reaching peaks of 37, 38 degrees. and which is a lot for my business. And in summer, there are certain plants that I can no longer grow. For instance, I cannot grow lettuce anymore in summer because they all die with the high temperature. So this has really affected me as in my own business. And another way that it has affected me is in my country. I come from Mauritius, a small island in the Indian Ocean. And with the rise in the sea level of water, what we've noticed that several beaches, exotic beaches around Mauritius, they are getting eroded. You can even see the trees with their roots, which is now the roots is now out of the sand. So this is becoming kind of scary. You understand that the climate change ripple effects is not going to come in 50 years, but it is coming slowly over us, and it is changing the way that we are living. And with the highest of the temperatures, which is happening, we are using more AC, we are using more other alternative solutions to be cooled, and now we are using more money in terms of that we are paying for electricity. So our quality of life is changing itself.
Our very quality of life and our homes are being eroded. What do you wish people knew about climate change? If there's something that you know and you wish that everyone knew about climate change, what's that one thing?
Is to understand that we are all going to be affected by it. It's not going to be only those who are polluting who are going to be affected. Everyone is going to feel the change. Everyone is going to feel the negative ripple effect of it. And what I want people to understand that we can control it by a change of behavior. Like, for instance, if we start to become responsible people and consume, for instance, in a responsible manner, we can start to reverse these effects of the climate change. So I want people to know that we are all in this, and together we can reverse it.
Definitely. And then if there's one action that you would encourage everyone to take up to address climate change, what would it be?
Okay, so if we do one action, so it's for me, it is that everyone can do from grassroots to the high level is responsible consumption. To control in a very responsible manner. So this is something that you shouldn't be rich to do that, or even poor, you can do it. Because being responsible in the way that we consume is going to be a way that we can address the climate change. I'll give you an example. Yesterday I went to eat during lunch. I went to a food court. And so the meal was served to me, and then the lady was giving me a fork, and I said, no, I don't need a fork. And she told me, but how are you going to eat? Because I just ordered a plate of noodles. How are you going to eat? And then I pull out my fork and I showed, no, this is my fork, because I'm not going to use a plastic fork, a single-use fork. So a change in behavior. So I brought my fork, I ate with it, I just put it back, and I washed it back at my work. So one change in behavior would change many things. So it's just how people need to adopt a new behavior from where we are going. So the ideas won't come like this, but eventually we as climate reality leaders, we should start to come up with winning ideas, talk to people, show the example, lead them in the direction, and eventually, if people accept it, and eventually we will be able to see some changes.
Many small actions make big impact. And then what are your efforts? I mean, I know you just mentioned that you don't use single-use cutlery, but what are your efforts towards addressing climate change?
So the efforts that I've done on a personal manner is that, for instance, in my house, I have invested in green energy. 50% of the consumption of electricity of my house comes from solar panels now, with the idea of pushing it to 100% in a few years, with more investment coming. But right now, since I've implemented it in 2016, I've seen that I have saved a lot on my electricity bills, especially during the summer when I use a lot of AC. This is number one. Number two is that we do not uh, the the vehicles that we use that are in our homes, we are moving to, we have already started to shift to hybrid cars, so to consume less of fossil fuel. My next car, which is going to be in 2 years, is going to be fully electric. I'm not going to use fossil fuel cars anymore, and which is going to be recharged with solar panels, just to make sure that I do not use home electricity, because some of my electricity still uses fossil fuel, so it beats the purpose. So this requires investment, so it will take a bit of time, but this is the idea of where to go. I have applied the principle of responsible consumption over myself. I never buy because there is a sale. I will never buy because something is cheap. I will never buy in excess because it is buy one, get three. No, I do not consume in that way now. I consume whatever I need, and I consume in a very responsible manner. And I spend also in a very responsible manner, and I consume, and I encourage everyone at home, be it my parents, my sister, my peers, everyone, we consume in this kind of manner. We have literally banned the use of plastic bottles at home, plastic bags. So everything which is single use, we have taken a collective action to ban it in our house, and we are also now encouraging. I'm personally encouraging the town where I live to encourage them to stop using single use plastic. To encourage the municipality, to encourage the local grocery. Personally talk to them to say, let's find a way. We are ready to help out, to educate people. We can educate people for you. We can launch campaigns for you to educate people that single-use plastic, you know, brings a lot of fossil fuel to do that. And for our country, it's not good. So these are the actions that we have taken. And also engage young people to take actions for climate change. This has been my primary action that I've done as a climate change leader, is to engage people to take actions for climate change.
Riyadh, thank you. Thank you so much for that. And it's inspiring how much you are doing as an individual towards sustainable consumption. You're living your truth.
I spoke to Riyadh last week and we ended on that high note. And this week I got back in touch with him to ask him about the oil spill.
So in light of the recent oil spill, how will that affect you personally and your business?
Okay. So to be able to answer this, we have to understand the reality which is going around Mauritius. Actually, we were one of the first countries in the world to be able to be COVID free. So we have been able to eliminate COVID since 3 months now, for more than 3 months now. And we were preparing the country to reopen again our borders for other countries, because our economy is very, very much dependent on the tourism industry. So at a point we had to reopen the borders of Mauritius. Unfortunately, now after having gone through the COVID, we are now going through something called what we call the environmental catastrophe. So what's happening is that the news has gone viral around the world that Mauritius is now we are a small island, and the spill is going all around the island. So it started in the south and it is moving towards the east. And with the current and the tide, it might go around the island. We have the risk. And what's going to happen with that is that we sell Mauritius as a paradise island. We sell our seas. We sell our beaches. And now those places, those attractions can't be sold anymore. What's going to happen is that we might take more time to open the borders. We need time to recover the ecological catastrophe, clean everything, and this might take a lot of time. We might even miss the prime period of October, November, December that we use, where we have the maximum people visiting Mauritius. So what's going to happen, especially to me, is that I'm also waiting for the border to open, to be able for my business to reopen. But now we are still in an uncertainty. We don't know, we cannot foresee how the economic situation will be in like 1 month or 2 months. So it's become difficult for entrepreneurs like me to make a progress, to be able to hire people, also to expand my business. So I'm just like on a point that I'm just still waiting and eventually wait for whatever is going to come to be able to take adequate decisions at a particular period of time. For myself, it's a real pity because this is the first time that we are going through this, kind of ecological disaster. It was out of our control. We know that our fish industry will also be on a halt for some time. Well, things are not getting any better for us.
That is tragic. Yeah. How do you see you guys recovering from this, or is it too early to say?
You see, actually, we have to manage on a day-to-day basis. We are unable to foresee, or we are unable to say when and where, when is going, when we are going to get out of it. We have no data to go on and say, okay, it has happened so much years, how many tons have gone into the sea, so we are going to take so much time to clean it up. We don't know. It's the first time we are going through it. But the good thing about it is that all the Mauritian people, we are just like giving our time. We are leaving our job. We are going to the beach, and we are helping to prepare barriers with plastic bottles and sugarcane leaves. We are putting it wrapping them together, and we are putting them on the sea to act as a barrier. So we are just doing it, and just for 1 week, we have done over kilometers and kilometers of these barriers. Even in my company, we are donating also certain of the materials for people to be able like to work with. So we are doing the maximum we can to protect our shore in a hope that we will be able to pump out all the oil, all the fuel in this boat before it wrecks. Yeah.
So in light of the recent oil spill, how will that affect you personally and your business?
Okay. So to be able to answer this, we have to understand the reality which is going around Mauritius. Actually, we were one of the first countries in the world to be able to be COVID-free. So we have been able to eliminate COVID since 3 months now, or more than 3 months now. And we were preparing the country to reopen again our borders for other countries, because our economy is very, very much dependent on the tourism industry. So at a point, we had to reopen the borders of Mauritius. Unfortunately, now, after having gone through the COVID, we are now going through something called what we call the environmental catastrophe. So what's happening is that the news has gone viral around the world that Mauritius is now we are a small island, and the spill is going all around the island. So it started in the south and it is moving towards the east, and with the current and the tide, it might go around the island. We have the risk. And what's going to happen with that is that we sell Mauritius as a paradise island. We sell our seas, we sell our beaches. And now those places, those attractions can't be sold anymore. What's going to happen is that we might take more time to open the borders. We need time to recover the ecological catastrophe, clean everything. And this might take a lot of time. We might even miss the prime period of October, November, December that we use, where we have the maximum people visiting Mauritius. So what's going to happen, especially to me, is that I'm also waiting for the border to open, to be able like for my business to reopen. But now on, we are still in an uncertainty. We don't know, we cannot foresee how the economic situation will be in like 1 month or 2 months. So it's become difficult for entrepreneurs like me to make a progress, to be able to hire people, also to expand my business. So I'm just like on a point that I'm just still waiting and eventually wait for whatever is going to come to be able to take adequate decisions at a particular period of time. For myself, it's a real pity because it's the first time that we are going through this, kind of ecological disaster. Unfortunately, it was out of our control. We know that our fish industry will also be on a halt for some time. Well, things are not getting any better for us.
That is tragic. Yeah. How do you see you guys recovering from this, or is it too early to say?
You see, actually, we have to manage on a day-to-day basis. We are unable to foresee, or we are unable to say when and where, when we are going to get out of it. We have no data to go on and say, okay, it has happened so much years, how many tons have gone into the sea, so we are going to take so much time to clean it up. We don't know. It's the first time we are going through it. But the good thing about it is that all the Mauritian people, we are just like giving our time. We are leaving our job. We are going to the beach, and we are helping to prepare barriers with plastic bottles and sugarcane leaves. We are putting it into wrapping them together, and we are putting them on the sea to act as a barrier. So we are just doing it, and just for 1 week, we have done over kilometers and kilometers of these barriers. Even in my company, we are donating also certain of the materials for people to be able like to work with. So we are doing the maximum we can to protect our shore in a hope that we will be able to pump out all the oil, all the fuel in this boat before it wrecks. Yeah.
Thank you for taking time to listen to this episode of Sustain 267 Podcast. I'll be posting new episodes every week of conversations with Africans on climate change and sustainability in Botswana and the rest of Africa. Please subscribe so you know exactly when a brand new episode is out, and rate this podcast to make it easier for others to find. I am the host of Sustain 267 Podcast, Bato Kilisitse, and the sound engineer is Maleho Makoti. Also like our Facebook page, Sustain 267. Please stand in solidarity with the people of Mauritius by taking action. It's as easy as a tweet, a Facebook or Instagram post, or sharing news articles on the oil spill. All these can be done from the comfort and safety of your home. The COVID-19 pandemic is still upon us, and lives are being lost throughout the continent. Let's continue to follow regulations so we and our loved ones stay safe. Take care.
Sustain 267.